From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM. Toronto.
CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Chams. Joining me in studio, my co-host,
Mally, aka Docu Vixen,
Kemla King.
And we've got two of the co-hosts sharing the mic with me, so I'll just pass it along to them.
Adrian Worrell.
And Ivana
Singh. Because we've got a bit of a full house today. We are just waiting one of our guests, but we do have another guest that I would like to introduce. She is a returning guest. We like to think of her as an extended member of the collective. Zainab Amadahi, welcome back to the Vibe Collective.
Thank you. It's always so much fun to be here. Yeah.
Thank you for joining us. And so we are the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we normally have roundtable discussions. We talk about important issues like social justice, decolonization, identity, healing, hip-hop, and all those good things. And then from 4 to 5, the DJs put it down. That's all I'm going to say about that. So today we've got a bit of a packed show. Hopefully our guests will arrive because we have another guest lined up at 3:30. We are awaiting Complex, who has a screening this afternoon or this evening for her film The Healing Wisdom of Jamaica. And I don't know if you guys had a chance to check out the trailer, but it looks really, really interesting, and I'm looking forward to seeing that.
I recommend it. I saw it in the fall, so I recommend people go and see the screening. It's really good. And yeah, people will enjoy.
Definitely. And then at 3:30, we will be speaking with a person who is on the West Coast and made a bit of a splash in the Indigenous social media world. I guess it was in the late summer. He started a sort of satirical Twitter account, and he's now moved on to Facebook as well. And he's known as Settler Colonial, and I suggest you all follow him at Settler Colonial. And he's really doing some interesting work with, you know, unpacking white privilege and examining it. He takes a very sarcastic approach, but he has a really interesting way of bringing that discussion from a white perspective, a white settler perspective. And it's really interesting. So we'll be talking to him a little bit later on in the show.
Awesome.
Yeah. So go ahead.
Well, yeah, in the meantime, I'd like to know about this film. And you know, Mally, since you saw it, tell me like a little bit about it, the approach it takes and what it discusses.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of Complex's journey in Jamaica and talking to various amount of elders within the Rasta community. And just sort of like going along and asking questions about, ways of healing through the land and through food. And so just basically and questions about what it means to be Rasta, and then also dispelling the sort of stereotypes of what it means or to be Jamaican kind of thing, and basically dispelling all those stereotypes that are put on Jamaicans. So yeah, it's sort of like sort of a journey story kind of thing. But yeah, it's really good. Yeah. It's what it's basically. I think the whole crux of the film is like whatever you know about Jamaicans is wrong. And I'm going to tell you what's you know. It's really good. It's really good.
As Mally closes her eyes,
you know, because you know all the stereotypes. I'm not going to repeat.
Right.
Are there universal implications in the film for health and well-being, like things? Oh, definitely. Are applicable to everyone?
Yeah, definitely. Like, like very universal, like you know, healing through eating and through like you know, sort of tilling the land. And there's also questions of like around. She interviews one of her, I think, her uncle and his experience coming here as a migrant worker, and what that was like, and then going back to Jamaica.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, it's really good. I don't want to give up more.
Yeah.
So people go watch it.
Yes.
Yeah, it sounds something like I would something the kind of film I would really love to see. Actually, yeah. I'm really interested myself in you know, African descended and diasporic traditions of healing, particularly those that relate to land and rely on land and relationships in general. Yeah, so so it's something I think I would really enjoy seeing myself.
And I think we need to see these things. It's very important. I remember, you know, in the previous show that I did, I can't remember his name, but I interviewed someone who's a pharmacist here in Toronto, and he was talking about the fact that it is important for women to eat ground vegetables like yams because it helps later on in life with menopause. And I'm like, I didn't know that, you know, like, so these are the things that we need to understand in terms of, especially in a society where we're told not to eat carbs because that will make you fat, right? But looking at, you know, how important these foods are to our well-being and how being connected to the ancestral foods that we had are important as well, right? Yeah, so.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me that, you know, colonial mindset for all of us kind of teaches us or wants us to believe that, you know, our well-being is really reliant on people with expertise and people with technologies and people with drugs. And we, you know, we aren't taught to realize that, you know, our healthcare and our well-being is very accessible. It's it's all around us. You know, I mean, it you know, it's in our food, it's in our herbs, it's in our teas, it's in our relationships, it's in sunshine. It's, you know, it's accessible to everyone. And and most of our wisdom traditions recognized that and relied on that for generations. And that's what kept our ancestors alive for millennia right now. But now all of a sudden, you know, when healthcare becomes a commodity, you know, we're taught something different.
And what another interesting is like how that knowledge survived. Like, that's really like amazing. And I think you know, especially within the Caribbean, how that knowledge has actually survived, and that's what I find very amazing when you start kind of, you know, talking to elders, how that knowledge is still there,
right?
And a lot of the knowledge comes through also blood memory, which I always find really interesting. And that was some of the work that I was really gravitating towards when I was in school, is the way in which blood memory works with Indigenous knowledge. Because especially for those of us who are disconnected from our culture or our identities or, you know, in various ways, and then you find those pathways and it sort of triggers something on an, you know, on a deep, deep level, on a sort of psychic memory level. And, you know, like knowing, you know, a particular stance to take when you're, I don't know, walking in the woods, or, you know, how to walk on the land, or you know, planting a garden and working with the soil, just these things that sort of come up. It's really interesting when you see that happening and you see that sort of manifest as you try to revitalize that connection.
I just wanted to, so this is might be a little bit off topic, but one of my subjects who, for those who don't know, I've been working on this film, probably it's going to be for another couple of years, but one of my subjects who just came back from Haiti, I had a conversation with her, and it was like a 2-hour conversation. So a lot of ups and downs. There's a lot of really communities that she kind of connected to, like were people who were doing sort of what they call peasant organizing and going back to sort of moving people back from Port-au-Prince and moving them back to the land or whatever. And there's a lot, and what she called like Monsanto like defense kind of thing. So, you know, teaching younger people to go to reclaim that knowledge, right? Because there's still a lot of communities that still have that knowledge, but you know, with the displacement into the city, a lot of that knowledge has been lost. And so, but there's a lot of, you know, older folks who are like, we need to save seeds, and a lot of like resistance from farmers in Haiti. You know, they burnt a whole, yeah, there's always been like organizing around Monsanto, and Monsanto's all over Haiti right now. So, so anyway, that sort of, it's related, but not really. But so that's really exciting, and I'm excited to actually dive more into that and see what's going on there on the ground. But yeah,
yeah. Well, I'm not too sure if Complex is going to make it to the studio today. I haven't heard back from her, but I do want to let people know, if you're interested in seeing this film, it's screening tonight. And it's at a very small cafe. It is 3 Westmoreland Avenue at the El Cafecito Espresso Bar. And the film is The Healing Wisdom of Jamaica. And it's a documentary film on the healing, especially with Rasta healing. And there's some really interesting questions that I saw Complex raise in a couple of the trailers that I got to watch, particularly around, you know, attitudes towards gender and homophobia and that sort of thing. Because, you know, as we know in Jamaica, it's a bit of an issue. And so there were some really interesting responses coming from some of the subjects in the trailers that, that I saw. I think she has 4 or 5 different trailers on her YouTube channel. Yeah. So, very, very interesting subject matter. And it looks like it's going to be a really interesting film.
It's everything that's, you know, about Jamaica is wrong, I think, is the tagline.
It sounds like Complex.
Everything you know about Jamaica is wrong. Yes, that's exactly what it says. And it's a 63-minute documentary challenging the stereotypes that Jamaicans are labeled with. So, yeah, and that's what the press kit says. Good one, Mally.
I know.
She's like, yes, I know, I was there when she wrote it. Well, I guess we would be remiss if we weren't to mention, you know, the violence that took place yesterday, and there was a lot of, you know, conversation going around social media about sort of interrelated violence. So I do want to give respects to the families and of the victims and the victims who are survivors. And I also want to remind people that we are also in the midst of a revolution here on Turtle Island, the Idle No More Revolution, which is interconnected. I know those things sound really, you know, far apart, but they're actually related. So I just wanted to bring that up.
I would like to say something, because especially the discussion that you were having on your page. I really want to challenge people's assumption that it's one person with mental health issues that does this, right? We have to look at this as being an outpicturing of the violence that we are experiencing across the world, in our communities, in our media. And if we even look at the occurrences now that these quote-unquote mass shootings are taking place, we can't say it's a one-off and it's rare. So, you know, engage people in those conversations, make the links between the different types of violence that we're experiencing and the ways in which we choose to participate in it when we don't rebuke it or challenge it.
And what's interesting to me is that in the frame when these like tragedies happen, certain things are not discussed, like who is manufacturing like semi-automatic like machine guns that are offering them for, you know, $400 that you could buy at Walmart. And, you know, like just think of, okay, they're $400, it's less than rent.
Right.
Like, right? You know what I mean? And you could pick up pick that up and do a massacre the next day.
And the leader of the free world who is crying on television is killing other people's children in other countries, right?
So. Yeah.
And I think that was the thing that was most disturbing and what led me to, you know, write something about it. And again, I don't mean any disrespect to,
agreed,
you know, to the families, to the survivors, to the victims. But the fact of the matter is that Obama was on television shedding crocodile tears because, you know, at the same time, he is the head of a state that has killed, I think the numbers are in the thousands for, you know, that horrible euphemism of collateral damage. And even to call them civilian casualties, I mean, that language is so problematic.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, how that begs the question. It begs the question. We have to make those connections. You know, this violence doesn't stand on its own. Yeah. It's not, you know, something that
it's not
we
in a
should
vacuum, yeah.
Exactly. It's not in a vacuum.
It also highlights the sort of because I've been watching this issue sort of from a few different perspectives, and this kind of systemic racism that also exists when this sort of takes place, in the sense that when Malia Yousaf is killed, when she was shot, or Malia Yousafzai, it became this issue about Islam opposing the education of children. And if you look at this shooting and you were to try and put it through that lens, you would say, well, this is about opposing the education of children,
mm-hmm.
right? Like this is, or you could try and spin it that way, I suppose. And it kind of bothers me that innocence and the value of life is different. In the U.S., there's shootings on a weekly basis in schools, but you don't hear about it because it's one dead or two dead, or it's a fight in a school or something like that. And it's just, it has to take this rich community in Connecticut to kind of, again, get everyone very upset. And the difference, again, from something like Columbine is this is a very wealthy area. And so whereas Columbine's kind of a depressed area, and when Michael Moore was investigating it, he was sort of showing us that their parents are working in Lockheed Martin and stuff like that and are poor. And then again, that when this becomes a matter for the wealthy, you have to have the sort of most powerful person in the world brought to tears over the death of children locally. And of course, he has to do that. That's part of the farce of U.S. politics. But when it comes to the death of these children in Pakistan, it really bothers me. And he didn't get my vote, actually, this year. I was rooting for him, but he didn't get my vote because I just can't have that on my conscience.
I hope that doesn't mean that you voted for the other guy.
No, Jill Stein.
Okay. Just had to check.
You think he was...
Not a two-party race.
Just making sure. Go ahead, Zainab.
I'm just thinking about, as well, what this brings up for me in terms of the systemic violence that's, you know, perpetrated on a daily basis. You know, which is probably, again, responsible for a lot more deaths than these sensationalized stories.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, you think about the tar sands and how many people are sick and dying and going to be killed by that, you know, resource extraction process. And also, you know, the fact that, you know, in any settler colonial society, I mean, the foundations of it are violence. I mean, settler, you know, colonial, you know, we're supposed to forget, you know, the kind of violence that enabled, you know, colonialism and capitalism to take hold, to get a foothold on this continent, you know, and the kinds of, you know, things that history, or, you know, that written history, that Eurocentric history likes us to forget, like the infection whole communities by smallpox blankets, you know, deliberate infection and these kinds of violences, you know. So anyways, that's the kind of thing it brings up for me.
Yeah,
again.
Thank you for making those connections. That's exactly what I'm talking about and why, you know, I said, you know, these are interrelated and interconnected issues. We can't ignore the violence that is perpetrated, especially on Indigenous women. I mean, we've got over 600 missing and murdered women that go investigated, and families are told, "No, sorry, that's an adult, so they can disappear if they want to, and they won't launch an investigation. They won't investigate it."
And law enforcement authorities are often very much involved, implicated in some of these disappearances and murders, or at least in thwarting the investigations of them. And it really, when you look at the statistics, I think Indigenous women, both sides of the border, are the only racialized women who are still much more likely to be assaulted by folks or killed by people outside of the Indigenous community as opposed to inside the Indigenous community, which shows you how much, you know, this kind of systemic violence is still part of, you know, like the ongoing genocide project still relies on this kind of systemic violence.
Mm-hmm. And that's why we have to make these connections. And I know it upsets people, and I know that they want to just, you know, wrap themselves in a bubble of mass mourning. You know, it bonds people when these things happen. That's the sick thing about these incidents, is there's almost a sick desire for people to bond together in this mourning, yet they don't want to look at the big picture. They want it to be just about this. They want to have their moment with Obama, and then, you know, they move on with life. And forgetting that, you know, this violence is actually permeating in everything now.
And what is interesting is that, the sort of rhetoric where we're like, it's not time to talk about this, right? Because we're mourning, but then we never talk about it when we're not mourning. Then also the way that this incident will now be used by the administration, which is so insidious, right? Now, I mean, Obama's rating is going to go way up now, right?
Oh, yeah, because he's the president who cries. And it's the second time he's done that in the last, month and a half?
Yeah, he did it with his
constituents and all his volunteers.
Yeah. Meanwhile, he got supported by the NRA. You know what I mean? Like, those connections are not going to be made. So, that's what I'm tracking now. Like, it's like now how this incident's going to be used to sort of, yeah.
Okay. Now, I do want to welcome our guest to the studio complex. Thank you for rolling through.
Yeah, what's up? Sorry, I'm late.
So we really will only have a couple of minutes because we do have another guest to get to at 3:30. But we did your doc.
Yeah.
Well,
we had a
conversation about it. You heard?
Well, no, but for just like, I just got the text, right? Like, I was right biking here, so when I sat texting. Down, I checked my phone to see what time it was, and I saw you texting me. Then my friend's like, "Yo, they're talking about you on CIUT." I'm like, "Yeah, I just got here."
So the screening launch of The Healing Wisdom of Jamaica takes place tonight. It is at El Cafecito Espresso Bar.
That's right. That's correct. It's at like 7 o'clock, and then we're gonna have another screening because it's a small place at 8:30, just in case people don't want to stand or whatever. And I'm looking forward to it. This will be the first time I kind of unleash it onto the world, aside from, you know, Melinda seeing it on my computer. I'm really excited to present it and, you know, get people's reaction and just assault them with some kindness.
Why should people see the film complex?
Well, they should.
How will we benefit from seeing the film?
You benefit from, like, you know, essentially I had conversations with majority of people are elders, so them talking about being resilient and healing from the trauma of being enslaved people, from, you know, cultivating the earth and how important it is to, like, have a relationship with the earth. Like, if you don't have an integral relationship with the earth, then you're not actually living, because you can't not live and not interact with earth, as well as being vegan, what it is to be a Rastafari, in terms of, like, back in the day when cops would shoot first and then ask questions later, but, you know, you don't really ask dead people questions. So that connection, as well as interconnecting it with Canada and how the slaves were supposed to be repatriated back to Sierra Leone, but they ended up actually just shipping them to Nova Scotia. And a lot of people don't know that, you know, that's some of Canadian history. Like, not only did, like, Africans, you know, come to Canada through slavery, and Halifax was, like, the first port for them to go all across the North America, but actually, like, you know, Jamaicans were shipped to Canada to, you know, slaves, be slaves and all that kind of stuff. So it's just debunking the stereotypes, because everything you know about Jamaica is wrong, because all you hear is that we smoke weed, we're criminals, you know, back in the day when I was younger, whenever there was a crime, oh, it's a Jamaican, and it's just like, shut up. You know what I mean? Like, so, yeah, it's, you know, when, like, I don't know what you guys are talking about in certain contexts, but, like, when mass shootings like this happen, we're always like, please don't make them be black. You know what I mean? We're just like, you know, because we're just like, because that's more shit that we don't need to deal with. So, not that it's a good thing when these things happen, but it's always interesting to see how people don't talk about, oh, when it's a white person, oh, there's mental illness. But when it's a black person or a person of color, it's like, oh, you guys are murderers. And how they don't even mention race when it's a white person, you know? So it's like those first, like, 20 minutes when they talked about it, I'm like, so there's no race going involved here. So it's a white person. You know what I mean? So, yeah. Also, I basically just did this film because I'm tired of all the appropriation that goes on. Like, everyone loves to, like, chant Bob Marley and wear their fake dreads and everything like that, but they don't understand, like, you know, everyone wants to be black until the police come. Everyone wants to take our culture and listen to our music and eat our food, but they don't understand the struggle and the strength that we have. So it's important to, like, document the stories from those people to tell it, as opposed to me telling the story. Like, I'm half Jamaican, but I'm born in Toronto, so I don't have a integral Jamaican experience, you know what I mean? But it's in my roots, like, 400 years, like, family, like, slaves coming from Nigeria to Jamaica, so, like, integrally, it's in there, you know what I mean? But, like, I can't fully tell the Jamaican experience, so go actually talk to a Jamaican, you know? So,
what was the one thing that you took away from the experience of filming that?
Just how strong people are, just how strong, like, Jamaicans are, and the strength that they have, even in, like, conditions of not having a lot, you know, like one guy said, he, you know, he's like, I don't live in a big house, you know, I don't have a fancy car, but, you know, I, you know, have my land, I grow my food, I have my family here, and, you know, it's all love, like, we, you just, you have to be thankful for what you have, and use whatever resources that you can to survive. And a lot of people take for granted, you know, like, our first world problems. Like, oh my God, like, I missed Walking Dead this week or something. You know what I mean? And, like, they don't...
My cell phone broke.
Yeah. Well, let's not mention that, okay? But, like, you know what I mean? So it's just, like, it's just, you know, having, you know, knowledge of self and love of self, and, like, how important it is to love yourself. You have to love yourself, because if you don't love yourself, then you can't love anyone else. And that's really, that's, like, one of the biggest things that I got out of this.
Well, Complex, thanks for coming through.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and again, it really looks like a really interesting documentary. I'm looking forward to seeing it. The Healing Wisdom of Jamaica, tonight. First screening is at 7, you said?
Yeah.
And it's El Cafecito, and it's 23 Westmoreland.
No, it's 3 Westmoreland. Westmoreland is one block west of Dovercourt. It's just north of Bloor. So, okay. Yeah, closer to the Ossington station, if you take that.
Okay.
And let listeners know where you could connect with the movie.
You can connect with the movie short form. My Twitter is @Complex. KALMPLEX, and that's got all my info of, like, how you can, like, email me, or thehealingwisdomofjamaica.wordpress.com is the website if you need to get in touch with me. And yeah, look forward to seeing people at 7 and again at 8:30. It's free, but I am asking for donations, because independently I did everything on myself, like, produced, edited, everything is all out of my pocket. So I'm trying to raise some funds so that I can submit into other festivals to get it outside of Toronto and everything like that. So,
awesome.
Yeah.
Support.
I accept PayPal too, so just email me.
All right, Complex. Well, thank you very much for coming through. Respect. for your film. It looks really good.
Nice.
I look forward to seeing it.
Look forward to seeing you guys there too.
Yeah. So you're listening to The Vibe Collective. We've got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Settler Colonial, who is taking a satirical approach to unpacking white privilege on social media here on The Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM. Toronto.
Come along, my brother, come along. Let us do the things we supposed to do for our mother. Come along, my sister, come along too. But if we should live up in the, 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 live up in the.
And if we should live up in the.
And if we should live up in the. Wash up the dishes. She even goes to the shop and bring in the groceries. When my smaller brother run around and pick up the bramble to keep the fire blazing, to keep on my fire blazing, blazing fire, fire.
And if we should live up.
Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM. That was Burning Spear, Man Up in the Hill, in honor of our guest Complex's documentary screening this evening, The Healing Wisdom of Jamaica.
Props!
And so we're The Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we normally have roundtable discussions. We talk about important issues such as social justice, decolonization, identity, resistance, culture, healing, wisdom, hip-hop, indigenous knowledge, and, all those good things. And then from 4 to 5, we bring you music to move you. I'm your host, Jams. Joining me in studio, my co-hosts with the Mahosts.
Mally, a.k.a. Docu Vixen.
Yes.
Adrian Worrell.
Kimba King.
And
Adnan Hussein. Hello.
Yes, we're sharing mics over on this end. We also have in studio with us special guest Zainab Amadahi, who is an author, a singer, a scholar, a writer, a researcher, has a book coming out in the next month, I believe it is. And can you tell us the name of your book, Zainab?
Well, at this point, it's called Wielding the Force, The Science of Social Justice. And what it looks at is how new and emerging science is kind of catching up to indigenous wisdom and other wisdom, the knowledge of other wisdom traditions, and how that science and that wisdom, applies to social justice. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It sounds really, really incredible. I'm looking forward to reading that. And we're really happy to have you here to join in this discussion. Also, Complex is still in studio with us.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then on the phone, we have with us a very interesting person who you may or may not have seen on Facebook and on Twitter. goes by the title Settler Colonial. Being North American is like finding $20 in your winter coat, except that both the coat and the $20 were stolen from an indigenous person. That is the description. So welcome to the Vibe Collective Settler Colonial.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So I heard about you. I think you had just started your Twitter account, and the host of Indigenous Wave, Susan Blight, who's very active on Twitter, told me, oh, you have to follow this guy, Settler Colonial. He's really funny. He's taking this satirical approach. And then we were trying to guess who you could possibly be.
Everybody thought I was Diaghi Alfred.
That's right. We all thought you were Diaghi Alfred, who we're really big fans of. And it turns out you're not him.
No. I wish.
Do you want to let us know a little bit about what inspired you to take this approach on social media?
Well, I had a Twitter account that was my own, and I found myself arguing and debating with sort of right-wing trolls all the time, and specifically about Indigenous politics issues and things like that. And so I found that it was too much to try. I don't know if you've ever tried to debate online with 140 characters, but it's pretty much impossible. So the only thing I could really manage was to get out sort of satirical, poking fun at what they were saying, repeating back to them basically what they were saying, but making it clear how ridiculous it was. And then I thought, well, why don't I just set up an account where that's all I do? And so that's I set up the Settler Colonial account, and then I closed my other account because I wasn't even using it.
and you're certainly taking a like I said, a very satirical approach. Do you find that some of your satire is lost on some of these people who you're targeting?
Yeah, well, that's the challenge, is to try and make it so that it's still accessible. I mean, nothing I say is not something that the indigenous people who follow me don't already know. It's just, for them, it's kind of maybe funny to hear somebody like me saying it. So the challenge is to try and make it accessible to my fellow settlers in a way that points out clearly how ridiculous it is, the particular perspectives or attitudes and things like that. Some of it is lost. Some people think that I'm serious, and so I get called a racist. But people generally quickly correct them and let them know that I'm being satirical. But I find that it's actually not that difficult to engage with settlers if you speak the right language to them.
Which is sarcasm and condescension.
Exactly.
Fluent in sarcasm. Yeah.
They totally get that.
I just want to quote a couple of your tweets from your favorites list. If you think you are your own worst critic, you probably haven't met a white male political science undergrad with rich parents.
I know a lot of those.
And the settlers did look upon the conquered land, and in considering its fate, did say unto their forebearers, drive it like you stole it. Wow. And then this is actually one of my favorites, and it relates to the Idle No More Indigenous Rights Revolution that is taking place. Remember when the healthcare system for white people went down? Me neither. # Idle No More. And that's referring to something that happened to Indigenous people this week. The First Nations insurance benefits, their health insurance benefits system got shut down. So people were going to the pharmacy expecting to be able to, you know, fill their prescriptions and get their medication. And the whole system was shut down. Now, online, we were seeing the Canadian Association of Pharmacists posting about this and posting support for people and messages to pharmacists, you know, what to do is you have to go to the emergency plan. But, you know, that was probably not a coincidence considering the movement, the Idle No More movement that is taking place right now. So Settler Colonial It feels funny to call you that.
Do you want me to out myself? I don't mind, because actually most of the people online know who I am already.
Okay, sure. Please let us know who you are.
Yeah, my name's Tobold Rollo, and I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto in political science. And I study democratic theory and its intersection with colonialism.
Ah, interesting. Tobold Rollo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for sharing
just
your
so you don't, yeah.
identity
it,
with
it
us.
It feels funny calling referring to somebody as Mr. Colonizer, so you can just call me Toby.
All right, Toby. So as a settler, I'm going to make an assumption, you consider yourself an ally. How did you come to see yourself as an ally and do this work?
Well, I guess there's life experience. I grew up fairly poor, and so like in a car, kind of poor, and often the car was parked on the outskirts of reservations and things like that. So I ended up being, you know, in close proximity to reservations and seeing the life there. And a lot of my friends were the native kids. And then I had this strange shift in my life where we ended up getting some money, and I ended up being able to, after different periods of homelessness and stuff, I ended up being able to get into academics. And so it carried forward my life experiences and seeing what was happening sort of on the ground into the sort of ivory tower scenario where everything was talked about very abstractly. So I decided to dedicate my academic work to it. The online stuff was really just an accident of being attacked by my fellow settlers, most of them, you know, racists and stuff. So
And as I think pretty much all of us in this room can relate to, you know, having those dialogues online at some point or another with mm-hmm. As you called them, trolls. and do you see that, you know, being a white settler, do you feel that you have a responsibility to do this work? Do you feel that, you know, because of things like privilege and perhaps, you know, not having to battle racism in the same way that, you know, racialized and indigenous people have, do you feel that it's a responsibility for you as a white settler to do this awareness work?
Absolutely, yeah. And to be honest, it's not very hard to convince settlers. So my responsibility in part comes from the fact that I'm a white male, now fairly privileged in terms of education and all these sorts. I'm very well situated to do this kind of work. In fact, I'm even more. I feel the weight of the moral obligation to do this work even more, considering these positions that I now find myself in. And I don't find it that difficult, honestly, to convince other non-Indigenous peoples of the moral importance of doing the work. The funny thing is that they'll listen to it coming from me, but as soon as they hear it from an Indigenous person, it becomes a complaint or
political.
They're not, sorry?
Or political. It becomes political when it's...
Yes, it's politicized, right? Whereas if I say it in everyday conversation, I can get a dialogue going, actually constructive dialogue going. So this is the strange paradox you find yourself in being in a position of privilege, is that it gives you kind of access that's not... I'm not shut out right at the door sort of thing.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. You know, carrying white privilege, being a mixed person, that is... definitely been my experience, and I see, you know, family members get shut out of conversation that I'm able to engage in, it's something that I think a few of us around this table can relate to in some way or another.
Yeah.
Zeynep?
Yeah, I was just wondering, because you know, you talk about, you know, how you have changed hearts and minds, and I wouldn't mind hearing some of those stories, but I'm also kind of wondering, you know, about the kind of long-term impact that you like to see, you know, happen as a result of, because I'm a Facebook person, and you know that I've friended you or liked you. I don't know what I did on Facebook, but anyways, and I really get a kick out of what you post. For me, it's quite amusing, but I just kind of wondered about the impact that you're looking for and hoping for, if you've seen it. What are sort of the long-term, you know, outcomes that you're looking at here?
In terms of using social media?
Yeah, yeah. In the way that you use it, yeah.
Right. It's too soon for me to say anything definitive. Part of my academic research, it's ironic, but most of it is talking about how the impact of words is so negligible compared to the impact of action and exemplars in society. And so at first, when I started doing this, I didn't think it was going, I still don't know actually what kind of impact it's going to have, if any. It could be just words on the internet. I have seen, you might have followed on Twitter around Halloween when all of the, you know, there's so many people posting pictures of themselves in traditional regalia, you know, non-Indigenous peoples, mm-hmm. and yeah. So real offensive images and things like that, and they got inundated, and I was a participant in that, in sort of calling them out, and there was a few people who blocked and shut down, but there's a few people who said, I had no idea, I'm not going to do it again. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you could say, well, even one person convinced is a giant success sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But as far as long term, anything systemic, I'm skeptical but hopeful.
Mm-hmm. But those kinds of things happen kind of one person at a time, anyways. Don't be the long term. Yeah.
Yeah.
I also think too, what I find what I really like about the approach that you take is, you do make some of us laugh, and some of the stuff is really quite challenging. But I know from my own research that, you know, how much, emotions, our feelings are kind of involved and inform our decision making and our political opinions and all kinds of other things. And I think that, artistic practices and satire and comedy are all ways of changing hearts and minds in that order, because that actually is the order in which it happens. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, I find that when something gets pointed out to you how ridiculous it is, when it gets repeated back to you with a little bit of a twist, I've found myself, when people have done it to me, it can be a moment of revelation where you're like, oh, that's really how I sound? Wow, that does sound completely racist and ridiculous.
I was wondering if you could speak for a little while about, I guess, some of the, state politics. Like, what do you think are the factors that limit the how far those kind of conversations might go in terms of in relationship to like settler state sovereignty and vis-a-vis First Nations sovereignty?
Well, that's a question that I would suspect that I might have fed you prior to this conversation, because it's exactly what my academic work is kind of on. So thank you for that softball.
Adrian's quite the quick to the moment researcher.
Yeah, right. So in my academic work, I try and make the argument, and I try and feed this into if you want, this kind of online activism, if you want to call it that, trying to press home the idea that state sovereignty sets up the terminal limit on what is discussable within especially state institutions, so state courts, legislatures, commissions, committees. And so what I do in my research is as I look at these scenarios and I show how even the most open non-Indigenous mind sitting at the negotiating table is limited in terms of what they can possibly do by the mandates of state sovereignty. So you'll get people in land claims negotiations saying, you know what, I've heard your stories and I completely agree. I see now the relationship to the land and the importance and all this sort of thing. But you know what, I can't do anything about it. I have to issue this report back to the ministry or what have you, and it has to be in these terms. And so they come actually to the table, which with what are called mandate letters, which basically outline the possibilities, the range of possibilities. And so Indigenous peoples in their communities and nations are running up against these. And it's really, you know, there's not much you can do at a negotiating table. And so in my research, I point to more practices, trying to highlight practices of challenging sovereignty and establishing sovereignty
mm-hmm.
for First Nations communities.
And some of those practices might be?
Well, practices of cultural resurgence, the kind of thing that Diag Alfred and Glenn Coulthard and lots of other Indigenous thinkers and activists and scholars and communities are engaged in, really being the, you know, being the change kind of thing, mm-hmm. enacting sovereignty in their daily practices. So that's something that they're doing. And I see the settler, or sort of the non-Indigenous responsibilities as being parallel. We have to deconstruct sovereignty on our side while they're constructing sovereignty on their side.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I think the relationship is.
Okay. And how does that I understand that you live on, someone help me with the pronunciation, territory?
Coast Salish.
Coast Salish?
Territory.
And how does your politics affect your situation, like in terms of decision to be there opposed to anywhere else?
Well, I was doing the PhD in Toronto, and mm-hmm. I got to the point where I was able to, I had done all the mandatory coursework and tests, so it was time to do the writing. And I had done my master's at the University of Victoria, which was very, had a big impact on me. Scholars like James Tully and Diag Alfred there. And so we decided to come back here because we felt like we could have more of a, well, we have a daughter as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt like I could raise my daughter, this is getting really personal now, I hope you don't mind, but I felt like I could raise my daughter in the kind of way that I would want to hear the lessons about relationships to the land and community mm-hmm. Were more accessible to us here than they were in downtown Toronto. We were at Yonge and Bloor. And so that informed the decision to come back here.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm just wondering, too, you talked about deconstructing sovereignty and that being one of the responsibilities of settlers. And I don't know if you're talking about white settlers or all settlers, but I'm just kind of curious what that would look like.
What the practice of deconstructing sovereignty would mm-hmm. look like?
Yeah, what does it look like? Yeah.
Right. So, but there's two approaches to it. There's sort of the intellectual approach and there's the practical approach. In my intellectual work, I highlight the practical approach, but I'm engaged as an intellectual, so I have to write a dissertation. The intellectual work is basically unpacking and deconstructing the history of the notion of sovereignty, right? Where does it come from? Why did it emerge? What were the conditions under which it emerged? How does it persist? And when you do that kind of work, you see that sovereignty, the Western notion of sovereignty, was constructed precisely for the purpose of this deep dispossessing. That's not the right word.
Dispossessing.
There we go. Dispossessing Indigenous peoples of the land. So the notions of private property and sovereignty emerged at the same time, around the time of contact, precisely for this purpose. And once you actually tell that to non-Indigenous peoples and walk them through that, there's a conversion, an intellectual conversion anyway. The practical conversion, how they live their life, is something completely different. So they can be converted intellectually but still live their lives as settlers and colonizers, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the much harder work, I think, that I'm still working on. Mm-hmm. The intellectual part, I think I've got an okay handle on. Practical work of deconstructing sovereignty and living a non-Western sovereign kind of life is much more difficult, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I think from my standpoint, you know, thinking about how, you know, the intellectual versus the practical is very important. It's something, the intellectual part is something that my friends and I have been talking about over the last couple of months. But the practical part, especially for non-white settlers, is how do we do this work mm-hmm. at this particular point, and not in a way that's harsh, but gentle, right? because we know that there are other oppressions through which we are continuing to survive from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't. There's lots of people who can speak to that. That are that's the sort of cutting edge of the work right now. It seems.
Yeah, there's a that word intersectionality that, you know, we can't ignore. Again, we were talking earlier in the show, Toby, about, you know, the intersections of violence with what happened yesterday, but outside of you know, that isolated incident, how, you know, it permeates. But it's the same thing with colonization. Colonization is, you know, it's kind of like this disease that has affected a lot of people on the planet. And those of us who have experienced oppression because of colonization have this sort of common thread in terms of an understanding of how insidious, you know, the symptoms of colonization can be. So it's interesting to look at that, as Kemba was just saying, you know, it's interesting to look at how to do this solidarity work. You know, earlier in the show, Complex is a filmmaker who's got a film called The Healing Wisdom of Jamaica, and Zainab does a lot of that kind of work around Indigenous knowledge healing. And that's, I think, one of the big obstacles is that, you know, a lot of our communities are in need of healing. And without that healing, then, you know, it's really difficult to look outside and look at how, you know, we can bridge these gaps when we're trying to piece ourselves together, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of nodding.
that sounds about right.
I think it's important from not one part of being an ally, I think, is not interfering with that process too much. And so I try and stay out of that discussion because my voice isn't really needed in that discussion until it's called for.
Mm-hmm.
I see my obligations and responsibilities as being able to work on my house, work on our house, in order that that work can be done between Indigenous peoples, the people of color, and different communities that are experiencing these multiple layers and of oppression and exclusion and domination, to make the space for that to go on rather than to get too involved in the conversation itself.
I just have to tell you that Kemba and Adnan are just on the other side of the glass sharing the mic with me. And Kemba, just when you brought up that point about, you know, that your voice isn't necessarily needed in that dialogue, she said, "I want to marry him." It's just refreshing to hear.
Yeah.
Somebody say that. In particular, you know, coming from the, you know, the location that you're coming from. So I also really appreciate that you said that too. So thank you.
I think that's the hardest lesson for progressive, open-minded, non-Indigenous peoples who really, really want to help. The hardest part is realizing that your help is to make space rather than to get in there. And although you'll be called on sometimes, but
like your today. Obligation,
like today, yeah, yeah. So I'm honored to be called on to talk. But one of the things I try to impress on my fellow settlers is that Indigenous peoples and people of color are not under any obligation to talk to us about themselves or educate us. And so when there's a tendency in Indigenous movements to talk about educating, and in addition to the cultural resurgence that's going on in their own communities, to talk about educating settler Canadians, and we really latch on to that. We love that idea. We love the idea of the Indigenous peoples coming to us and educating us and crossing the gap themselves. And so, sorry, did you want to say something?
Yeah, Kemba's in love with you.
Yeah, Kemba's swoon, full swoon.
I want to actually ask, when you have had those discussions with white settlers, like, what has been their reaction, especially the folks who consider themselves to be leftists and want to be in the mix because they see themselves as needing to be there? Or have you even had those conversations?
I mean, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, all the time. Because I was one, actually. You know, the sort of stages of progress you go through, or not progress, it's an Enlightenment idea. Just the stages you go through as a non-Indigenous person who wants to help. The first stage is, I want to get in there and dig in the trenches with the Indigenous people. And there's a tendency for a lot of them to play native, and there's a tendency for a lot of them to take up the space of the discussion. And there's a tendency to import the ideas and principles that are foreign to the conversation, and in doing so, to kind of import colonialism right back into the conversations. So the hardest part is to not do that, and that's one of the big discussions that non-Indigenous peoples and white people and male heterosexual able-bodied white people have to have with themselves, is this conversation about amongst themselves in their own house about how not to displace the conversations and practices that are already going on.
Toby, you are speaking right into our hearts, and I'm wondering if you do any kind of workshops around this, because you know, it's desperately needed. There are three of us around this table are part of a group of people doing some of this work amongst, you know, racialized and Indigenous communities, but in terms of that white privilege awareness when entering into, you know, these spaces, is that something you've considered doing, you know, taking that into academic spaces and activist spaces and sort of doing that kind of white privilege deconstruction work?
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out how it can be done properly, because I think it's the conversation that needs to happen but hasn't quite happened yet. And it's difficult to know just how to do it. I'm sorry, I can't be too much more helpful than that, because it is the conversation that is just starting. And part of the reason it's starting is because of the pushback from communities who are dealing with decolonization, right? Saying, okay, thanks for your 2 cents, but can you please let us speak now, kind of thing. And so that's kind of forced settlers into a kind of, at first disgruntled, but then accepting, okay, well, then I'll just sit here sort of position. And so the tendency is to sit in stasis and wait for Indigenous peoples to decolonize, and then the Indigenous peoples are then under some sort of obligation, I guess, to come and decolonize us. And so the conversation hasn't happened yet. We're still sitting in stasis. And so part of what I'm trying to do with the satire online and in my academic work is trying to get that conversation going and trying to get the practices going in our own house, in the non-Indigenous communities. So I've thought of doing it, but I just don't know how it would be done yet. There's probably people who are working on this that are smarter than me that are doing pretty good work, I would imagine.
Well, yeah, it's good that there are so many people working on this these days. There's been such an amazing shift in awareness, you know, I would say over maybe the last 8 years from where I sit. But anyways, I was just kind of curious, because a lot of these conversations, you know, that I've been involved with over the years, you know, around decolonization and allyship and all this kind of stuff kind of become binaries. It's, you know, what do... You know, Indigenous, you know, there's the Indigenous responsibilities and things on the one hand, and then, you know, the responsibilities of white folks on the other. And I know that I've been involved in projects and initiatives where racialized folks kind of, you know, are kind of, you know, feeling that they've been pushed out of Indigenous solidarity spaces, for example.
Yep.
Or yeah. And I'm just wondering if you've, you know, you know, from your vantage point, have you seen that? Why does that happen? How do you address it in your work? That kind of thing. Yeah.
If I'm being honest, I'll say I have no idea. And
that's refreshing.
What's that?
That's refreshing to hear somebody say, you know, I don't know. That's okay. You know.
Honestly, I'm not situated in a good. I'm not. I don't know. I don't understand properly. I just don't know the kind of conversation that needs to take place. I just I guess I'd want to just express that I'm really aware of my limits, mm-hmm. and my limits really are. I'm white, able-bodied, male, heterosexual, privileged guy who's on the internet, and I will chirp sometimes about certain things just to get conversations going, but I'm not sure what I could add to the conversation about the kind of intersectional problems that occur with settlers who are not colonial, who are within indigenous communities, when they get excluded and under what conditions.
No, I'm actually talking more about, you know, in... you know,
oh, you mean a white guy among
white,
you?
Yeah, among, you know, yeah, white in white spaces where people of color, you know, hope to enter to become, you know, to become allies and to build their relationships with, you know, indigenous activists and indigenous communities, and then
right.
feel that they have to leave those spaces because white folks have kind of pushed them out of it.
Oh, so, okay, yeah. I'm sorry, I just wasted 2 minutes then. Well, that happens. I mean, this is a systemic problem, and it happens. It happened in the Occupy movement. It happens in academics. It happens everywhere. Cultivating the kind of democratic ethos that allows for all the voices to come in within a non-Indigenous sort of settler discussion is difficult. Intellectually, it's easy. There's plenty of white people out there writing papers about inclusiveness. There's too many papers about inclusiveness. There's not enough inclusive practices going on. And I think when the intellectual approach to inclusiveness takes over, you get practices of exclusion just sort of creep in. And I'm myself engaged in trying to develop this ethos of inclusiveness, and it's kind of a personal journey that people have to undertake. I'm not sure if it can be approached systemically. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Does it address your question, though?
Yes, you answered it. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You're really pressing the bounds of what I'm capable of answering now. Thank you for pressing me.
Well, I thank you for taking the time to speak with us, Toby. We've sort of come to the end of our spoken word part of the show, but I'd like to, you know, perhaps have you back on the show later on at some point to continue this dialogue. I think that there's definitely a role in particular within the white activists and white academic community that a really important role that you can play in terms of, as you say, deconstructing those privileges and you know, pushing yourself to look at them as well and pushing others to look at them, because you know, a lot of people who try to engage in that way, and I've had friendships that as soon as it becomes racialized, you know, and the friendship falls apart, it's really sad. It makes me sad. I don't like when that happens, but it does happen, and it often relates to privilege and how that plays a part in being, you know, shut out of conversations or, you know, have the Indigenous perspective patronized and treated as though it doesn't have the same kind of validity that, you know, white Eurocentric academia does. I'm referring to Indigenous knowledge or Indigenous philosophy, so, and something specific. if people are not familiar with Settler Colonial, you can follow him on Twitter. It's very simple. It's at Settler Colonial. We just tweeted at you, so you can find him on our Twitter, and you're also on Facebook. So people can like you there, Settler Colonial. And thanks for taking the time to speak with us today, Toby. It was really interesting.
Thank you for including me.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time and the honesty that you brought to the table. It's funny, people get threatened by you know, admitting things like, oh well, I don't know. But it's really not that big a deal to not know or not have all the answers. So Yeah,
just so don't tell any of my golf buddies that I admitted to not knowing something.
Okay, we'll be sure not to do that. Okay, so you take care and all the best to you, Toby.
Okay, take care, everyone.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Okay, you're listening to The Vibe Collective, and we were just speaking with Settler Colonial. We've got to take a break, and when we come back, DJ Griffin's going to take over for the musical part of the show. And we'll be back on the other side on CIUT 89.5 FM.